I next met with Dr. Panos Fidias, and as a follow-up to my discussions with Drs. Camage and Johnson, and specifically the issue of multiplex genomic testing, I asked Dr. Fidias to comment on the approach being used in his oncology department at Mass General.
The platform that we have is called Snapshot. It's a multiplex DNA sequencing platform where it started really as a research tool trying to identify oncogenic drivers, with EGFR, of course, being the most frequent of all of these. But at some point, several years ago, we thought that this should not be just a research tool. It should be integrated into clinical practice, because imagine it, if you really did this only as a research tool and you had to have a protocol, you only can approach maybe 15, 20% of the population. And by definition, this population will be a selected population, and it doesn't give as many answers as you really want to. Definitely nothing when it comes to generalization of your results. So we thought that every single lung cancer patient that comes to the clinic should be genotyped. And what we've been doing since then is having this Snapshot platform that's now been supplemented by FISH analysis, primarily of the ALK translocated gene, and more recently the ROS1 translocation. But we also do MET, FISH, and other a little bit less common rearrangements and mutations for everybody who comes to the clinic. So this was a model that proved successful in clinical practice. We get a lot of data. We get a lot of data that are unexpected data. You would not have selected those patients necessarily for these types of mutations, but you do find more as you do more. And this has now spread to the other disease centers where breast cancer and colorectal cancers are now being screened.
So just to pick up on that, you know, it's interesting, your paper that came out was December 2011, and I actually don't see ROS1 on there, because I guess it kind of, you mentioned that. Maybe you can just comment on what ROS1 is, and maybe we can focus in a little bit on some of the different mutations that are found, that you found, and kind of what they might mean. How about ROS1?
Of course, ROS1 is the new kid in the block. It was presented this year in ASCO by Dr. Ali Shaw from our group, and it was presented in the context of being a sensitive tyrosine kinase to crizotinib. So we do see results, therapeutic results with crizotinib. ROS1 was picked up in a phosphoscan initially. It is a tyrosine kinase. And in the tyrosine kinase tree, it's very, very close to the ALK tyrosine kinase. Based on that, there was a thought that it may be inhibited by crizotinib, similar to the ALK tyrosine kinase. And lo and behold, in the lab, it does get inhibited. And we published that in JCO earlier this year. And in this year's ASCO, Dr. Shop reported on a handful of patients that were treated with crizotinib on an expanded phase 1 study, which showed similar response rates to what crizotinib shows for ALK rearranged lung cancer, which is about 60-65% upfront responses for metastatic disease.
Yeah, you know, sometimes there's more to understanding things in numbers. And when you had that JCO paper came out, you had one case.
Correct.
But you had the scans in there, and, you know, you just look at that and you realize this person got a novel therapy agent alone, and this is what happened. And then I guess you all reported another 7 patients. Did you take care of any of these people yourself?
Yes, and I have at least 2 patients currently on trial that have responded to crizotinib. I've never seen a person who has not responded. Now, there's a difference between seeing a response clinically and seeing what would be a RECIST 1.1 response, but I've never seen a single person who has actually done badly on these medications.
You know, people kind of now are starting to get this model in their head, starting out with the EGFR TKIs of what can happen with a mutation, and I guess it sort of globally seems similar. But you also talked about other things that we're seeing, and I'm just kind of curious, beyond crizotinib and EGFR TKIs, what you think either are or might be in the future, quote, druggable targets.
Yes, this is an area of intense research effort and interest. There's several mutations that are potentially druggable, like the BRAF mutation, for example, which we know is very druggable in melanoma, maybe not as druggable in colon cancer, and question how druggable it may be in lung cancer. One thing that we learn is that not all mutations in all diseases are the same, and they may not necessarily respond to the same type of inhibition.
Now, you all reported 2% BRAF. Now, were these V600E?
They're not entirely the V600E mutations. There's much more frequent non-V600E in lung cancers as opposed to melanoma. I would say it's about 50-50 that you see non or you see true V600E mutations when it comes to BRAF.
So have any of these lung cancer patients with the 600E mutation been treated with BRAF inhibitors, remurafenib, for example?
Yes, they have. And some of them, since remurafenib has been available commercially, have been treated, I know that as a matter of fact, off trial. We do have trials where we check new BRAF inhibitors, and we have trials that also evaluate the combination of PI3 kinase inhibition with MEK inhibition, so pathways that a sort of parallel and bypass what BRAF activation may cause.
But I mean, have there been patients with the kind of responses that you all put with the scans in the JCO with the ROS1 with vemurafenib and these BRAF?
Not as impressive, not as definite as you would see, for example, in melanoma.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be that kind of response. So far, I personally have not seen this kind of activity with either vemurafenib or other BRAF inhibitors in BRAF mutant lung cancer. Mind you, though, these are still small numbers, and these are cases that have been treated with a variety of different inhibitors, usually in phase one trials. I think it's too early to tell for sure, but nothing that has come up the same way, for example, that gefitinib had initially with EGFR mutated lung cancer, or crizotinib has with ALK or ROS1 cancer. I have not seen that.
So let's shift to a few more practical questions and some of your work. And you were involved in a paper, a consensus conference that was published recently on an issue that there are a lot of questions about, which is maintenance treatment. You also presented some stuff on this at ECHO ESMO. And I thought maybe we could talk about your 80-year-old patient as an example of how this issue comes up in practice, and then maybe you can reflect on this consensus discussion.
Correct. This is an issue that has come up the last several years in the lung cancer community. The teaching that we always had when I was a fellow or a younger attending is that more chemotherapy for advanced lung cancer is probably harmful, and less chemotherapy, just enough to get the cancer controlled, is all you need. And all of the studies that we did with more versus less chemotherapy did not show any benefit with more chemotherapy. Some of them showed more toxicity with more of the same chemotherapy. And then right around 2007 or so, we first published a paper with what we called early docetaxel versus late docetaxel. This was a study of carboplatin and gemcitabine in those patients that had at least stable disease or response, went on to receive docetaxel immediately after the end of their chemotherapy, or they were scheduled to receive the same chemotherapy later at the time of their progression. What happened with that study was that the progression for survival, maybe as you would expect, was significant in the immediate docetaxel arm, was significantly longer. And the overall survival was longer by about 2 months, which was borderline statistical significant. This is something, of course, this is a term you cannot use in journals. There's no such thing as borderline significance, but the p-value was 0.08, and the hazard ratio was quite good. There was an absolute 2 month difference in median survival. Subsequent to that, other studies continued along the same path, and the two different strategies that evolved was to either switch to another type of chemotherapy different from the induction chemotherapy, pretty much like what we did with the docetaxel, and that under NCCN, and now I think it's a globally accepted term, is called switch maintenance chemotherapy, or to continue the same chemotherapy you were given before, but not the same regimen, to give a lower dose, a lower modified dose of your prior regimen. Typically, you would drop the platinum and you would continue with the other single agent. And this has been called continuation maintenance. This is similar, for example, to what ECOG 4599 did, where they dropped both carboplatin and paclitaxel and continued with bevacizumab. This, of course, was never a randomized trial, so the value of the bevacizumab maintenance has never been proven on a phase 3 study. But there have been studies, like the study with the pemetrexed switch maintenance, where patients received a variety of platinum doublets and then moved on to get either pemetrexed or be observed in a best supportive care arm. And that did show an overall survival benefit for non-squamous cell cancers, which was quite significant, an absolute difference of about 5 months. And then, more recently, you have the Paramount data, and the Paramount is a study of continuation pemetrexed. Pemetrexed was viewed to be a very reasonable choice for continuation, just because the experience of clinicians dealing with this medication is that it does not cause a lot of cumulative toxicities, and that's an easier medication to give, I would think definitely much easier than continuation docetaxel. So pemetrexed in the Paramount study was a continuation maintenance where patients received cisplatin and pemetrexed before and then when randomized to either receive pemetrexed or best supportive care. Last year in ASCO, we had the progression-free survival data, PFS data from Luis Pazares presented, and this was statistically significant. This is something, I think, to be expected. Continuation therapy will always have better control of tumor compared to no therapy at all. But this year, they also presented the overall survival data, and the benefit still holds in a statistically significant fashion. And it holds across all subgroups, whether they had stable disease or whether they had responsive disease. This was, I thought, a good study and, in my mind, solidified the use of pemetrexed as a continuation or as a switch maintenance approach. Parenthetically here, I would say that a study which is not as mature as the Paramount is a study called AvaPerl. This was presented last year in ESMO. And the AvaPerl study, you can envision it as a Paramount with bevacizumab. Essentially, it's the same chemotherapy, cisplatin, pemetrexed, with the addition of bevacizumab as induction, and then the randomization is between bevacizumab maintenance or bevacizumab and pemetrexed. It turns out that the progression-free survival of the arm that receives continuation pemetrexed and bevacizumab is in the order of 10 months. So this is progression-free survival, and it sounds very similar to what we used to get for overall survival with all of our lines of chemotherapy. So I think these studies prove that with ongoing chemotherapy, you can push the survival barriers further. The question, and we can talk about it, is for whom and whether it's worth it. Because numerically, you can achieve that. There are some criticisms, as they should, with all of these studies. The initial criticism that we heard was that the control arm really did not receive a lot of chemotherapy. So in essence, you were evaluating chemo versus no chemo. I don't think that's a correct criticism, because the most recent studies have shown that up to 80% of patients in the control arm do receive chemotherapy. It may not be the identical chemotherapy as in the treatment arm, but...
And you're talking about second-line chemo.
Second-line chemotherapy for the control arm. In the docetaxel study, in our study, 63% did receive docetaxel. This is as good as it is in most frontline studies that aim to give second-line therapy. It's very difficult at the time of progression to give chemotherapy to 100% of these patients. So one reason why maintenance may work better is because the reality of clinical practice is at the time of progression, you cannot really give 100% chemotherapy to everybody. But in continuation approach, you can. So that's the practical aspect. The biological aspect is that even if you give 100% of chemotherapy to the control arm, the fact that you gave treatment earlier in the treatment arm, that proves that has a survival benefit. And again, there has not been a study as clean as that, where everybody in the control arm received second-line chemotherapy, which was identical to the chemotherapy of the treatment arm. And I think this study would be very difficult to do because of practical reasons. But most of the recent studies have shown a steady increase in the percentage of patients in the control arm who do receive chemotherapy. So I think that argument is relatively thin.
Well, also, you know, you could say, well, the reason they're not getting treated is they get too sick and they're dying.
I think you're absolutely right.
So just to kind of take that and the science of it and the trials of it and bring it back to practice, again, how about this 80-year-old lady? Can you talk about how she presented?
Yes, this is a lovely, lovely woman I'm still treating. And she's 80 years old. She looks like 65, and she's doing her Pilates, and she goes to the gym every day. She's very involved in the community in all sorts of activities, and presented from her PCP sent to me because of progressive cough. And unfortunately, the scans that she had showed mediastinal adenopathy and a sizable right upper lobe mass. Went ahead and biopsied the tumor. It was a typical adenocarcinoma. We see, I would say, 80% of lung cancers around here being adenocarcinomas.
Smoker?
Smoker, former smoker. We did run all the usual panels since she was wild type on everything.
Just out of curiosity, did she have a KRAS?
No, she did not have a KRAS. She was truly wild type on all mutations that we tested.
I meant to ask you before, when you were talking about KRAS, if you can get the mutations, is there really a practical reason, a non-research reason, for a doc in practice to get a KRAS?
Well, one of the main reasons to get a KRAS is that you can get it faster than all the other mutations. So maybe an algorithm would be to get a KRAS mutation first. And if this is positive, then I think that it's not really necessary to even look down the path of an EGFR or ALK, because for the most part, we don't see them together. And an EGFR analysis may take a couple of weeks. KRAS analysis, within a week, you have the results. So that's a practical aspect of it.
So now, where exactly did this lady have the disease?
It was primarily in the chest and bilateral lungs. So it was stage 4 on the basis of bilateral pulmonary involvement.
And was she having any symptoms from the disease?
Cough. Yeah, she had significant cough. And retrospectively, the more you talk to her, she did have progressive shortness of breath, where she could not do her usual multiple activities as well as she could before. So she was clearly symptomatic. In good performance status, really no major comorbidities. And we treated her with what I would consider to be one of the standard combinations. And we gave her carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. This is the same treatment that the Point Break study employs. This is another study where we don't have results yet, but it's one of the reasonable combinations. And I think with this particular person also, she did not want to lose hair, and not using a taxane made sense as well. So for many different reasons, we chose on a carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab arm. She did very well.
Can I just ask you, I do hear people in many solid tumors starting to get a little bit nervous about bevacizumab in older people. This lady was 80. Is there an age, 85, 90, assuming no significant comorbidities, where you pull back from Bev?
There is an age, I think I would pull back from intensity of therapy, but I wouldn't necessarily single out the bevacizumab from other medications. I know there's a concern. And there was also a paper in JAMA not that long ago that showed no survival benefit for older patients based on Medicare data.
Could I just ask, as long as you brought that up, do you think that's a legitimate kind of research? I have heard investigators kind of not too happy with that paper.
Yeah, I was not that happy with that as well. And the issue with that is that you don't really have all the information. You have what the intended treatment was, but you have no idea about dose intensity. You have no idea how people reacted. You have no idea what the subsequent treatment was. And to retrospectively go back and refute what prospective phase 3 studies have shown, it's provoking. It's generating of hypotheses, but it should not be used in clinical practice for decision making. I don't think so.
Now, how did she do with the carbo, PEM, and BEV?
She did very well. Her tumor had a very good response. Symptomatically, she improved almost back to baseline.
Any toxicity of treatment?
Cumulative fatigue is the only treatment toxicity that you can never take away. But she did not have any significant toxicity. She did not have any toxicity that landed her in the hospital, and she never had any.
No hypertension?
No. She did not have any vascular toxicities. In a sense, sometimes you would like to see hypertension. Hypertension has been linked to better results with bevacizumab, and it's one of those toxicities that it's relatively easy to treat compared to, of course, bleeding or clotting. No, she did not. She really did not have any major toxicities from that.
So she is getting treated, and then I guess the issue came up for her like it will with anybody. Okay, well, how long is this going to continue? What kind of maintenance?
Correct. We finished 4 rounds of chemotherapy, and she had a good response and no evidence of progression at the end of her 4 rounds of chemotherapy. So at that time, we had the usual balanced discussion, especially with a savvy and clever patient such as she was. And we discussed the issue about quality of life, about continuation at a lower dose, about whether we should continue with pemetrexed or with pemetrexed bevacizumab. My sense was to continue with pemetrexed bevacizumab primarily because of what I knew from the Avapearl data, that that has been the longest PFS interval that I've ever seen. And she did very well with the regimen before. I thought she would continue to do well on the maintenance regimen. And she hummed and hawed, and she was all about not interrupting her quality of life. But in fact, what she realized is that her quality of life had actually improved on chemotherapy, because the amount of cough and shortness of breath that she had at presentation was limiting her. And now on chemo, even though more fatigued intermittently, she found more of her life back. And this was a good point for her to grasp and something to measure. And ever since, what we've been doing, we've been saying, you can continue chemotherapy as a maintenance. We know that numerically will delay the recurrence and will probably make you live longer, but you can also measure whether the continuation of therapy continues to fulfill your most important desire, which is to still have your life back. And that's what we're doing now. This is the kind of treatment discussions that we have every time that we have scans. So far, she's received 8 cycles of maintenance chemotherapy, and she continues to do well. She will have scans coming up later this summer, and we'll have another discussion at that time.
So she actually, I guess in a way, got one of the arms of the Point Break trial that you're just talking about.
Exactly.
It's kind of like the Point Break trial is kind of being compared to so-called 4599 carbo, paclitaxel, bev. And bringing in the maintenance question, I guess we think maybe we're going to be seeing some data on that sometime, maybe this fall. Is that a strategy that you use frequently? Is it the usual strategy you use in EGFR wild metastatic disease?
I think it's one of the common strategies that we use, not just myself, but at MGH in general. We think that pemetrexed is probably an easier medication than paclitaxel. But it's not a consistent strategy, I would say. It varies from physician to physician, sometimes from patient to patient. But that Point Break arm is one of our usual treatment strategies.
You kind of think, in a way, some of this is, it is about tolerability and actually being able to continue a treatment for a long term. In this case, she's seems like she's done really well. But and you mentioned paclitaxel toxicity, and your group's reported on a slight variation of the 4599 regimen with carbo, nab, paclitaxel, and bev. What did you all see there, and do you have any sense whether it's any different than 4599?
I have to say that this has been a harder regimen than the 4599. We've definitely seen much more myelosuppression. The studies of nab-paclitaxel have not consistently shown a significant difference in myelosuppression. My sense is that it was more myelotoxic. At the same time, we have seen the highest response rate, for what it's worth, the highest response rate that we've ever seen with any regimen. So I would say that it's early to tell whether nab-paclitaxel should replace good old usual paclitaxel. It's more intense regimen. It has a little bit more myelosuppression and fatigue, but people can go through it. A motivated person can go through it. And we've seen very good results in terms of response rates. I know that in general, there's no known overall survival benefit with nab-paclitaxel or over paclitaxel. And it remains to be seen exactly what role it will have in the treatment armamentarium that we have.
It's been interesting to see this play out over the years with not just lung cancer, but more even with breast cancer. But one of the issues about the nab-paclitaxel on both and beyond that is the lack of need for corticosteroids, although I'm not sure exactly how much is used with regular paclitaxel. How do you approach, you know, this lady didn't have any comorbidities, but a lot of 80-year-old people are going to have at least type 2 diabetes. Does that give you any pause for corticosteroids or any thought about NAB?
No, not necessarily. You can limit the use of steroids around the time of the chemotherapy, and diabetics will need better and more strict control of their diabetes around the time of the steroids. But most oncologists really have been given paclitaxel since the early 90s. So most oncologists are very, very familiar with dealing with all of the side effects of paclitaxel. So that alone would not make me switch from a paclitaxel to nab-paclitaxel. I'm speaking for myself. That alone would not.
So, you know, one of the questions that comes up with squamous cell is the issue of EGFR antibodies, specifically cetuximab. Do you think there's a role for it? And do you think there's a role for using the IHC score?
At this point, most oncologists dealing with lung cancer have said no. So the FLEX data really have not motivated clinical practice. Most oncologists do not routinely, in the upfront setting, give cetuximab for a squamous cell cancer patient. And we do not routinely do an IHC score for EGFR expression.
So let's finish out talking about your 45-year-old man who actually ended up on a trial that you were commenting on, the Lux Lung trial that was just presented.
Yes, this is a young patient, very active, absolutely no comorbidities. He's an architect, and he ended up in the hospital on the neurosurgical service because he had neurological symptoms. It's been some time ago. I frankly don't remember exactly what symptom brought him in the hospital, but we were involved in this case after we knew that his MRI showed a single brain metastasis from a lung tumor, since the CT scan of the chest did show a right-sided lung cancer. He's a never smoker, was completely surprised, underwent craniotomy, resection of the metastasis, and that was followed by whole brain radiation. That's fairly standard. The result from the craniotomy specimen did show an adenocarcinoma consistent with a lung cancer. This was consistent with the clinical data as well. But mutation analysis did show an exon 19 deletion. This is one of the most typical mutations for EGFR. That and an exon 21 point mutation are the two most common. There is a lot of debate whether one is better than the other, and some studies have said yes, some studies have said there's no major differences. The studies that have said there's a difference consistently show that the exon 19 deletion is better than the exon 21 point mutation. But be it as it may, they're both sensitive mutations. So we were very excited about that, and we thought that he could be treated on an EGFR TKI or an EGFR TKI protocol. At that time, we had the LuxLung-2 trial. This was a trial, a phase 2 trial of afatinib, the BABW medication, either on frontline EGFR mutation positive patients or after use of chemotherapy. And he qualified for the arm of no prior treatment and started on afatinib at the usual dose, a once-a-day medication. It's an irreversible pan-HER inhibitor. So the theoretical advantage it has over medications such as erlotinib or gefitinib is that it irreversibly inhibits EGFR, and at the same time, it inhibits the tyrosine kinase activity of the whole HER family. There's never been a head-to-head trial that has proven superiority of these medications, the irreversible inhibitors over gefitinib or erlotinib. In fact, the irreversible inhibitors have not been able to surpass, by themselves at least, resistance, specifically the T790M resistance that develops on the first generation TKIs. Be it as it may, this was a very good approach, a very reasonable approach for such a situation. And frankly, this guy is one of my best examples of a responder. He had a magnificent response, and he continues to be on treatment about 3 years after the fact. He continues to work. He has the usual toxicities, which are primarily skin toxicities and paronychias, managed by ourselves and by dermatology. And we wait every so many months to see the scans, and so far, thank God, the scans have looked stable.
So I guess at ASCO, we saw some data, kind of reminded me of some of the trials that were done with erlotinib, kind of IPASS kind of thing, comparing it to chemo.
Correct. The LUX-Lung3 study was presented in ASCO, and this was an upfront comparison of afatinib versus cisplatin pemetrexed, similar to the Urtac, similar to the IPA study, similar to the Optimal study from China.
With erlotinib.
Yes. Yes, the others were erlotinib or with gefitinib. The Urtac and the Optimal had erlotinib. The others had gefitinib. The idea is all the same with all of these trials. And this was similar to what the other trials have shown. It showed a PFS benefit compared to chemotherapy. It showed a quality of life improvement compared to chemotherapy. It showed the hazard ratio of about 0.5 for the typical mutants in terms of PFS. This resembled the results that came out of IPASS initially several years ago and have been since confirmed by the other studies. So the practical aspect of it is that if somebody has a person who is known to be EGFR mutant, then that person should probably get an EGFR TKI therapy up front as opposed to chemotherapy. It does not mean to say that they should never get chemotherapy. It does not mean to say that if they get chemotherapy first, this is wrong. But it seems to be better, in terms of PFS at least, to receive an EGFR TKI up front.
At this point, do you think afatinib is going to become available?
I think it's definitely another choice.
I mean, has it looked any different than the other two?
To me, by numbers, it did not look significantly different. The toxicity profile seems to be about the same. It is a little bit more toxic when it comes to skin, paronychia, and GI disturbances. It seems a little bit worse than erlotinib. Whether that strategy will mean less resistance over time, I don't know yet. The PFS looks the same as in the gefitinib and erlotinib trial. So in my mind, I view them pretty much equivalent.
So final question. Another ASCO paper I was curious on your thoughts was actually a poster discussion, the SELECT study, and your colleague Lisa Sequist has been very much involved. I don't know, maybe you even put patients on the study.
Oh, yes.
So just real briefly, what did they look at? What did they find? What do you think it means?
It's way too early to tell. This is way too early. This is an adjuvant trial of EGFR mutation positive patients with classical mutations up to stage 3 that can receive erlotinib either immediately if they don't get chemotherapy or at the end of their chemotherapy if the standard of care for their tumor stage is to receive adjuvant chemotherapy after their resection. This is a single-arm phase 2 study, so it will not be a conclusive study. This is still too early. Dr. Joel Neal, prior fellow in our group now in Stanford, presented it in the poster discussion session. I think it's an interesting approach. Remember, the Canadian data last year were not that favorable for adjuvant erlotinib, even in the mutant population. So I think we need to take our time to see what the mature data will show. But the PFS looks remarkably well. It's still very early for this early stage patient population. And we'll see how it falls along the historical lines. And then eventually we'll need a phase 3 study to see if that's the new standard of care. I would not be surprised if that's the new standard of care. And my sense is that the EGFR TKIs for mutants will have to be moved earlier into the treatment algorithm. It's a very effective therapy. And you could imagine giving TKIs both adjuvantly. Remember, you have a chemotherapy, you have a cytotoxic approach that in the metastatic setting causes 20 to 30% of the tumors to shrink to the level of a partial response. And then you have those pills that cause tumors to regress about 70, 75%. And the cytotoxic chemotherapy, you can barely give for 2 to 3 rounds. The compliance in the adjuvant setting of a cisplatin-based regimen is about 60%, 70% for 3 cycles. So it's not a great delivery. But you can give pills for 2 years. We've done it in the metastatic setting. For sure you can do it in the adjuvant setting. And you give a cytotoxic medication that is better than classical chemotherapy. So it is not crazy to imagine that this will be the new paradigm. It has not been proven. Similarly, it is not crazy to think that you can give TKIs for locally advanced disease before radiation or even before surgery. This can shrink tumors much, much faster and better than chemotherapy. But what the role is, too early to tell. The adjuvant data from the Canadian study, the BR19, if I'm not mistaken, again, were not positive at all. And that gives us pause. I think we should step back a little bit, view what all the new and updated sets of data will show. Eventually, we'll need a phase 3 trial just for EGFR mutant patients.
I guess I should remind our listeners that the Canadian BR19 trial showed that 2 years of adjuvant gefitinib did not improve disease-free or overall survival in a patient population that was not selected for EGFR mutations. But I got to say, I really don't understand why there hasn't yet been or isn't currently an ongoing trial right now trying to answer the obvious question of an adjuvant TKI in an EGFR mutant population. It's kind of disturbing to me, to be honest with you.
Because it's for cure. It's in for increased cure. The first time that we can talk that TKIs have cured.
But why isn't the trial already up and running?
I'm with you.
I mean, you know, I'll just mention, it's only, 30-some patients, et cetera. But, you know, what you all reported, 2-year disease-free survival, 94%. That's not too bad. Of the 10 patients who recurred, 1 recurred during erlotinib treatment, the others after stopping it. You know, kind of interesting numbers.
Interesting numbers. Too early to tell.
We shall see.